Hey, Los Angeles. Are you looking for unique 4th of July plans for you and your friends or family? LA's greatest rivalry returns to Rose Bowl Stadium for a July 4th edition of the El Tráfico soccer matchup as the LA Galaxy return to their original home to defend their turf against LAFC. Last year, a record crowd of over 82,000 fans were on hand to witness the Galaxy victory. That's July 4th at Rose Bowl Stadium. Guaranteed fireworks both on and off the field and a celebration for all of LA. LA Galaxy versus LAFC, the Rose Bowl edition. Tickets at lagalaxy.com/tickets.
Welcome back to Now. No opportunity wasted. I'm your host, Angelica Ross. Now, today's episode is a lively conversation with my good friend, Marianne Williamson. So let's just go ahead and get the tone started right with a word from Buddhism Day by Day by Daisaku Ikeda. Today is Monday, March 11th, and it says, quote, "The Indian philosopher Swami Vivekananda declared, 'It is religion, maker of men, that we need. It is education, maker of men, that we need.'" Fostering people, building character, this is absolutely fundamental for creating a bright future. Toward this end, both the profound spirituality of religion and the intellectual illumination of education are essential. End quote. Now, I love quotes like this because Daisaku Ikeda frequently quoted various minds and thinkers and leaders from all over the world throughout history. And I think with this quote, he's pointing out the fact that, you know, there's, I think, for a long time been a battle between, you know, religion and science, or, you know, education and religion. You know, a lot of times I grew up in spaces where people felt like the Bible was all the education they needed. But I think that we see a lot of problematic things when people rely solely on religion, especially when we know that so many religions are taking advantage of the fact that many people are not educated and are leading the sheep to the slaughter. But also when it comes to education, like, there's a lot that we can learn, but we also have to learn that information alone is not the way. So he talks about the profoundness of profound spirituality that is in religion, not just religion alone, but the profound spirituality of religion. That is something that we need that makes us want to reach beyond our own understanding, or, you know, reach for that higher level of vibrational frequency, which I'll touch on a little bit later in our Buddhist breadcrumb. But to start off, I'm going to kick it off with, now what? A section of the podcast where I talk about what's been going on from politics to pop culture. So I want to know, did you watch President Biden's State of the Union address? I watched some of it at about 1.5 times the normal speed, but ultimately I just decided to read the transcript. In his address, President Biden touched on a myriad of issues facing the nation and the world, from the aggression of Russia in Ukraine, the defense of democracy and freedom, both domestically and abroad, reproductive rights and LGBTQ plus rights, but he also reaffirmed America's commitment to NATO and criticized political division while addressing economic growth and challenges, including the need for fair taxation and healthcare reform. President Biden also mentioned the importance of tackling climate change, improving education, and the critical situation in the Middle East, specifically the Israel and Palestine conflict and Iran's threat. Now, President Biden called to also pass the Equality Act and explicitly said to transgender Americans, "I have your back." Now, I believe I recognize that line from the last State of the Union address, but I still need some specifics and a more detailed plan of action addressing specific challenges faced by the trans community and the LGBT community at large, including healthcare access, violence, and discrimination. The ACLU is tracking 478 anti LGBTQ bills in the U.S. And so, Mr. President, I would love to know what your plan is to help us with that. Every day, LGBTQ plus Americans are contemplating moving, leaving their homes, their jobs, their schools, and their state to flee violence and oppression. So where can we seek asylum on American soil? President Biden also talked about economic growth, and when addressing the economic disparities, he mentioned bringing those high rents down, which is an issue that has recently been reported that 50% of Americans cannot afford rent. Biden said he would crack down on big landlords who are violating antitrust laws. I'd like to see that. What would a Biden crackdown look like? Biden also explained, President Biden also exclaimed that he would restore Roe versus Wade. My question again is how? What steps are you going to take right now, or are you planning to make that a reality? During the president's address, he said, "We have more to do. We have to help cities invest in more community police officers, more mental health workers, more community violence intervention." Listen, we know that Biden is planning to develop 69 cop cities across the country. And there has been a ton of protests around the development of Cop City right here in Georgia. Mary Hooks, as I mentioned before, said at one of those protests, if you don't allow the people to vote and verify the signatures that they have collected, then don't come begging for our vote later. Mr. President, we do not need more police. We need an alternative to police. Instead of building a campus for police to practice their moves on us, how about building a campus for the latter half of what you mentioned? More mental health workers and community violence intervention programs. So plain and simple, it is shady to have a business and a process for the people to be heard, yet our politicians are preventing that process from happening while also claiming to be the champion of democracy. The math ain't mathing for me. How about we decriminalize being poor in America? And instead of sending our tax dollars to war, let's address the poverty in this country. I believe that if we do that, we'll have less and less need for police. And is it just me, or does it seem like President Biden doesn't have the same energy for Netanyahu as he does for Vladimir Putin? President Biden urged that Ukraine can stop Putin if we, America, provide the weapons. That's all they're asking, he says. They're not asking for American soldiers. On this issue, President Biden made it clear that we will not back down. Vladimir Putin also made it clear that any NATO country that tries to interfere will risk, quote, a conflict with the use of nuclear weapons and therefore the destruction of civilization. So my next question, Mr. President, is how are you going to protect us from a nuclear war? Can you ease the growing anxiety of the American people who now have to worry about the increase of a nuclear threat? The Pentagon reported that China is on track to double its nuclear arsenal by 2030. Israel has an estimated 80 to 400 nuclear warheads. Why? Why is this world so invested in war? Why is evil necessary, especially nuclear war that could end life on this planet as we know it? One of my mentors, the second president of the Soka Gakkai International Buddhist Organization, said, quote, although a movement calling for a ban on the testing of nuclear weapons has arisen around the world, it is my wish to go further, to attack the problem at its root. I want to expose and rip out the claws that lie hidden in the very depths of such weapons. I wish to declare that anyone who ventures to use nuclear weapons, irrespective of their nationality or whether their country is victorious or defeated, should be sentenced to death without exception. Why do I say this? Because we, the citizens of the world, have an inviolable right to live. Anyone who jeopardizes that right is a devil incarnate, a fiend, a monster. Even if a country should conquer the world through the use of nuclear weapons, the conquerors must be viewed as devils, as evil incarnate. And I couldn't agree more. Now, before we move on to my conversation with Marianne Williamson, I just want to shed light on one more story. People magazine reported on Saturday that a woman struck by a New York City subway train after being pushed onto the tracks by her boyfriend has lost both her feet. Now, someone I follow on Instagram, Janae Wright, actually DM'd me that it was actually a trans woman who was pushed in front of that train. She says that she was pushed for not wanting to have sex with him, allegedly. I'll circle back to the story once more details are available. But in the meantime, I am praying for her healing and swift justice. Now, have you heard? Marianne Williamson has unsuspended her campaign and is back in the race. After President Biden recently received 100,000 uncommitted votes in Michigan as a protest vote, the president is now starting to finally understand just how unhappy we are with him. So I took to Instagram and I asked the people, but why is Marianne not an option as a shake the table vote? And I got back a couple replies. One person said, quote, she has said some things and allowed people on her show to say things that were construed as anti-science, anti-vaccination, but now she claims she is for vaccines. Another person commented, she's a delusional, overly spiritual wackadoo. So I asked Marianne about all of that, and we sat down and discussed the challenges she's faced, as well as the opportunity that she sees for America if we were to vote for Marianne Williamson for president. Well, welcome to Now, Marianne. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. You know, didn't you and I meet once during the 2020?
During the 2020 presidential debates in Iowa? Yes, specifically. Yes, exactly. I'm so glad that you remember because, you know, I that was such a interesting moment for me. It was a great moment. I really enjoyed the conversations with you and with everyone else backstage. They announced me as the host of this presidential debate. But when I got there, it was more like I was the host, you know, introducing the segments, but not asking the questions. I have a balance like you, I believe. And this is one of the things that attracts me to you is that I feel like I understand how to communicate in a room and sort of be within bounds of diplomacy-ish, but also say the things that might be unpopular or say the things that need to be said. And you're one of the few people that I've seen sort of continue to use your platform to break through and still say the unpopular thing. How do you feel like that has had an effect on both your presidential run prior in 2020 and your presidential run now?
Establishment politics is kabuki theater.
Yeah.
It's mainly performative. And as you just said, it exists more to thwart the most authentic conversation than it does to actually facilitate it. And that's why, like you said, you're more likely to have the real get down, let's be real, let's be authentic and be meaningful backstage than in front of the curtain.
Yeah.
I think it's even worse in 2024. Than it was in 2020, because the powers that secure that level of inauthenticity are so empowered now and so enabled by the almost trance-like state of the traditional Democrats in too many cases, who for whatever reason, one which I simply cannot understand, there is this willingness to believe these people when they say, trust us, we got this.
Yeah, I don't really know what that's about.
These are the same people who gave us Trump the first time.
Right. You know what? I want to say, though, if no one else has said it, I just want to say a huge thank you to you for your contribution to the conversation, the ways in which you push all the candidates to have to speak on things that they didn't have to speak on before. I appreciate you for being really a person of faith instead of wearing it as a costume and as a political play for votes, because I find myself in similar spaces with you as a community and leader and, you know, different organizations or whatever. And I speak a language that is grounded in spiritual practice. And so I've understood everything you've said, from the fact that we experience poverty the way that we do in this country because America is poor in spirit. I understood what you mean, you know, just when you understand having a spiritual lens on society's problems, and when you talk about reparations, not only do you talk about it from, I feel, an understandable place, but spiritually speaking, to understand what it means to atone. And so there are things that you uniquely bring to the space that no one else is bringing. And if no one else has told you, I want to tell you thank you.
Well, that means a lot to me. Thank you, because I know the level of your profound contribution as well. And I did then. Thank you. It means a lot to me. I also know that as American women, this leaves us with further questions. Mm-hmm. Because what it says to me is, okay, we've gotten to the point where we've got some of us laying it down. We've gotten to the point where there are enough of us who will acknowledge each other for laying it down. But none of that means that we have access to political power yet.
Yeah.
And the next step has got to be that not only do I hear you, not only do I acknowledge you, but we're going to do this, because otherwise our democracy and even our species are at risk.
Well, you know, I have to say that I am so grateful because my experience, spiritually speaking, has been a tumultuous one. One, though, that I think has been perfectly profound for me, but it still has been this tumultuous space of coming up in the Midwest, growing up in an evangelical family, learning that I'm an abomination and all these different things, to getting to a space and going and meeting some spaces and faith spaces and churches that may not have been that oppressive, but for me, they were still falling short of being able to affirm the worthiness at go, worthiness at birth for people like me, for the journey and growth and development of people like me. It was falling short to acknowledge that for me. And so eventually I was introduced to Nietzsche and Buddhism and chanting Nam-myoho Renge-kyo. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but what has also been quite moving for me is the president who was 95, who just passed away, the president before him, and the president before him, that all had these moments. In the 1960s, President Jose Toda had this very searing commentary to abolish the nuclear weapons, and saying that any person who is in the pursuit, basically, of creating these weapons basically should be taken out. It was like he was like so blunt about it, but he was like saying that anyone, that all of us have the right, unalienable right, to live, to exist, and anyone who would threaten that for, you know, the planet should be treated as a threat. all throughout, and each of them have had their own various sort of pinpoints, but this last president has written peace proposal after peace proposal to the UN to disarm nuclear weapons. But of course, now with what's going on in Gaza as well, I love being in this space where people who are spiritually centered are also using that lens to address and speak up, and what I say, take responsibility for, as I've learned it, as the ability to respond, to use that lens and respond as a spiritual authorities or leaders or whatever, to say the path forward is not this way, it's this way. And I know that you, with your you created the Peace Alliance, and like I heard you speak about, if you were president, that you would want to put money into creating a department that was focused on that. And I'm thinking to myself, well, that sounds like, you know, a great, that sounds like a great idea. Not only like, and then we have Cop City coming up in Atlanta and a campus. And yet I'm thinking, what would it look like to have a campus that was dedicated to creating peace in our communities? But how do you get from being someone like yourself and talking about this idea and creating these organizations to having the impact that I know you want to have from the pulpit of the presidential, you know, spot? Do you think that that's the only way that you might be able to reach that?
Well, it's so interesting that you start with talking about nuclear bombs, because that's where my head has been all day today too, since there was this a statement put out by the Republican congressman over the last couple of days about a developing nuclear potential on the part of Russia that could be used in outer space and so forth. And I, like you, feel that we need to challenge the belief that these weapons even should exist on this planet. I'm in 100% agreement with you on that. You know, we can't even have the same vital conversation about non-nuclear proliferation that we used to have, much less reduction and ultimate elimination of these bombs at all, starting with Obama and then with Trump and then with Biden as well. It seems it really doesn't matter whether they're Democrat or Republican. They fall in line with the primary goals of the military-industrial complex, and that includes the nuclear industry. So you are absolutely right, in my opinion. We need to point out something more than this needs to be tweaked here or there. We need to point out that this is insane. This is insane. Yes. This is the human species making a lot of money off its own suicidal march. Yes. To self-destruction.
Yes. Yes.
Now, you're right. I ran for president on the radicalism of that commentary. It should not be considered radical that we suggest right. that we should increase the probability of the human race surviving. What should be considered radical is all the ways in which we decrease the possibility of the human race surviving. Now, what I felt as a presidential candidate is that while there might be, well, I believe that there are a vast majority of people in this country from all places within the political spectrum who at heart would agree with what you and I are saying. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's number one. Mm-hmm. And I think that right there is an opening of possibility that is extraordinary. That's mm-hmm. number one. Number two, I saw even more in 2024 than I had seen in 2020. The extraordinary, vicious resistance of the system as it is mm-hmm. to anyone carrying on such a conversation as we are having on a platform that would might actually challenge their economic or political
it's
power.
Visceral, yes.
Number three, and this is where I feel we are right now, not enough people are willing to say, we need to do this. And I will not be dissuaded from using my voice. And if I see someone running for office saying this, I will help her. I will help her. Or him.
Well, Well, you know, and it's interesting that you say I will help her because, you know, I have been asking people, I've been having conversations with a lot of people because I just like, okay, you guys, like, what is it with Marianne? Because I'm not seeing it. I'm not seeing the issue. I'm not seeing like where the disconnect is with you guys. Like, I'm not seeing. And you know, for some folks, what I've heard back is, you know, in this country, I think that white women have been, in a way, almost like escaping association with some of these problems through talking about like patriarchy things without an intersectional lens, of course, but also and quietly benefiting not only from the privilege, but when we look at the polls and see where white women are voting, there's a disconnect to what white women say and what they do. And this is just as I'm getting some of these things and I'm listening and I'm like, but she speaks on, you know, reparations and understands, you know, poverty and all these different things or what have you. And I think that the general census that I get is that there's still somehow in messaging or something a disconnect for the experience of these folks in these communities. But when I was talking to this friend, I pointed out that her shortcomings, whatever you think they might be, it, to me, it sounds like you're still willing to accept that from a white man, though, like from a Joe Biden or for whatever. And their flaws that we all are pointing out or talking about, you know, why are there sometimes glaring shortcomings? And to me, it has been, it seems like it has been misogyny and patriarchy. Is that what you feel like has been a big portion of your experience?
A lot of that misogyny internalized by women, mm-hmm. in exactly the ways you just pointed out. Patriarchy, misogyny, both once again from women as much as men, because when it's internalized, we're even more blind to it. And also, I think if you actually look at not only what I've said, but what I've done with my life, that projection onto me would be dissolved.
That's how I feel.
Life in the last 40 years.
I look at your trajectory. I was watching some interviews and I was looking at your trajectory and I, you know, from Project Angel Food, which who introduced me to the practice, Alex Bowling, like has told me about that for years and has volunteered for, I think it's been like a decade at least that it's been around that long at least, right? Mm-hmm. Yes. So, because I know that he has been like volunteering for as long as I know.
But the Phantom was actually founded in 1989.
Yeah, exactly. So like from that to, I know a lot of your various work. And so it may not have been within the system of being a congresswoman, which I know you ran for and were not able to get the seat there. And I see you tapping into the system. But me personally, I feel I've seen your fingerprint and footprints outside of the system. I keep asking this question of like all these other folks that want to run for president and what they're going to do for us when they get into office. My question is, everybody is trying to tell us about the dangers and the real fear of having a Trump presidency. But what? I don't know. I feel like I don't hear or know, or maybe obviously it's not a conversation that should be had now. I don't know. But what are these people going to do?
They are not offering anything.
If he does get elected, like, are they just packing up and going home into their, what's happening?
Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, first of all, on their website, they have nothing. They have no issues page. When I heard the vice president ask the other day, well, what are you going to do in the next 4 years by a journalist, her response was, we just need everybody to vote. They don't even pretend to be offering anything. So much of this is unconscious. We're supposed to line up and say, oh, but they are somehow, they represent a better alternative. By the way, I'd like to go back if I might. Mm-hmm. What privilege I've had beyond this fact that I'm a white person, The privilege, the social and economic privilege I have had was given to me by a Black woman, Oprah Winfrey. And I think the issue with privilege is, what have you done with your privilege? What have you done with your privilege?
Marianne, that's a point. That's a point. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a point. I say that's a point because, you know, Oprah has been known too, you know, like there's been critique for Oprah in the sense of, like, you know, how she many times her platform has benefited white women, but you are one of the white women who's then taking that platform that has been kind of like amplified by being on Oprah's stage. I was kind of a part of that audience that watched that rise and watched the episodes as you like powerfully spoke. But I felt like you have contributed and done, I personally do. And like I said, I want to always just kind of affirm the work and the intention and the things that you have done, but also sort of challenge like where the growth that you think that possibly you yourself to break into the space. Because what this, you know, podcast, now, No Opportunity Wasted, is always about is about how we make the most out of the opportunities and challenges of the situation. And so, you know, one thing, as somebody who follows and loves you and all of the different things, there was a question I saw, and it had to do with Palestine and Israel. And I remember you saying something around like Israel has a right to exist. And I also know that you have grown up in Judaism. Am I correct that you?
Yeah,
you
I am a Jew. Yes.
And so I did an interview with Aaron Axelman. I don't know if you're familiar with the film Israelism. Mm-mm. Oh my goodness. Okay, so it's done by one, you know, perfect Jewish girl who's just seems like, you know, but she's sort of challenging the system of what they have been told coming up in order to create a lens to think that all Palestinians are children of darkness or to join a military and do these things. So they use a film and they break down like things from summer camps that kids are thinking they're going to summer camps, but part of it is like a reenactment of military things that they start to learn, or it's like, and you have soldiers who are talking about their experience and how they thought they were doing the right thing, but realizing how they were groomed from a certain, you know, standpoint. This film has been traveling around the country doing screenings at, you know, campuses. Sometimes it's been canceled, but then put back on. And it's this searing truth around, similar to the documentary Jesus Camp, around how sometimes there's a conflation with faith and government militarist forces and, you know, their colonialist, you know, sort of agendas. And so when I, you know, think about, I've seen in the video, they have a clip of Barack Obama. They have a clip of Joe Biden talking about the relationship that America has to Israel. And you know, I know that I'm not the smartest person in the world, and I learn and I read and I do things or whatever. But as a Black person, I can understand from 1948 Nakba and the first ethnic cleansing of and the story that goes well beyond October 7th of just how this is not the story that we've been told, that is complicated. And one thing that I heard you say that I thought that I think that you should immediately put on a T-shirt is, it's not complicated, it's corrupt.
Well, the propaganda on both sides. I don't think you can have a meaningful conversation about the things that you just said without talking about the extraordinary amount of money that has been spent by Iran in Saudi Arabia and others, having Arab children grow up thinking that the most beautiful thing would be to murder a Jew. I mean, this. Both sides. People say both sides.
But right now what's happening a lot though is thought versus action. Meaning, I get that. But what's happening in real time that's streaming on my phone right now is the murdering of Palestinian children. Is like well beyond the number, or like well beyond October 7th of what's happened. Coming from a spiritual space, I'm never one to want to be cheering on violence and what have you. But the way that this, I've stayed out of this conversation for so long because I believed that it was too complicated to understand. And as we start talking about it, there's very not complicated things about the real actions that are happening on behalf of Israel and the ways that a child, how can you not label them, I guess, a child of darkness when they're born in the dark, when you control their electricity, when you control their movement, their water, you know, and they're living in an open air prison. But then to still see joy sometimes on my feed that while they're being bombed, somehow they're dancing a dance in a square, or they're making art or doing things, even though they know that they're amongst their last days. So what I'm saying is, we know the conversation. Mm-hmm. Sure, we know about the evils on all sides of this, but I'm talking about literally the fact that there's a narrative that kept being pushed about October 7th, and when we don't, like you said, with reparations and all the things, if we don't talk about the context of what brought us to this moment, then we're not really talking about the issue.
Well, I think that that's true in terms of the larger context of October 7th. And I have been talking about that for years. And I've been talking about it both sides of the ocean. That is true, the systemic injustices. However, I don't think that the atrocities of October 7th and an acknowledgement of them is just a quote-unquote narrative being pushed.
Well, it is when the way that the media... I don't know if you've seen the way that the media has been playing this, from the newspapers to the media outlets, is to, it's as if we don't already and haven't already acknowledged the horrors of October 7th, but it keeps being brought up as a excuse as to why they must continue moving the way that we're moving.
I don't think that the press is saying, you don't have to agree with the war on Gaza, which I do not agree with it, to recognize that it is a reaction to what happened on October 7th. Both are true. Both are true.
So I agree, but do you know that, okay, at least here's what I know that I think I've known has been reported, that Hamas gave Netanyahu a warning a year in advance that if we don't experience whatever we want to experience, that we're going to have this attack, or we're going to do this attack.
No, what now, happened?
Yes.
What happened was that Netanyahu was warned, not by Hamas, but by Israeli military. There was one woman who said something's going on the other side of that. And Netanyahu, in his arrogance and in his smugness, said, nah, they could never do that. Somebody tried to show him some military plans, and he, in his smugness and his arrogance, said, nah, nothing they could ever pull off. And I think that a lot of the rage, you know, the Irish prime minister said the other day, Israel is blinded by its rage. And I think that part of what's going on here on Netanyahu's part is rage at himself, hatred of himself. Plus, he knows what would happen on the other side of this.
But do you think, I feel like his plan has always been to make Gaza a paradise for Israel. I think that plan has been clear for a really long time.
No, he is very right wing. He's a Trump. The people who are in charge of the government there think of Trump here. Okay, it's in some cases, to be honest, it's kind of the same people. Some of them. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So yes, he's moved in a very right wing direction in the last 15 years. He has represented forces that have made true justice, what you and I would say is true justice for the Palestinians, a more and more diminished possibility. This is in no way to defend him in any way. The idea of the 2005 retreat from Gaza, however, I think was very much on the part of Israelis at that time, a belief that this could be a kind of pilot project and we'll see what happens. At that time, no one expected there was going to be a democratic election. No one expected Hamas to win. And once again, Netanyahu, in his arrogance, in his smugness, he thought, stupidly, he thought, well, I don't want the Palestinian Authority on both sides. So he actually was part of the forces that supported Hamas. So this was terrible, 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 terrible. But at the same time, I'm not willing to in any way diminish the atrocities or the horror of October 7th. And something you said earlier that I hear sometimes when people watch what people do, not just what they say. Well, I think what Sinwar did what Sinwar did, it should be taken very seriously. It's not just what he said, it's what he did. And Sinwar has said that we would do it a million times over. Now, that does not equate with my agreeing with the actions in Gaza. And it does not, and I am horrified.
Because we're watching capital punishment. We're watching, collective punishment. We're watching people, these are civilians and huge
on
numbers
that,
paying the price.
You and I are in total agreement on that.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
And so, I feel like there needs to be a strong call to not only cease fire, but again, I just, as you are clear about acknowledging all of the things, I want to be clear about acknowledging all the things as well, in the sense that, like, the FBI here in America considered the Black Panther Party and many Black leaders, including the Black Lives Matter movement, to be a terrorist organization. When we take up arms, then all of a sudden the conversation shifts on.
Think about what it would have happened. I said many times when January 6th happened, I said, can you imagine what would have happened if they had been Black?
So
you and I would agree on that.
We agree on it, but I feel that this is why a lot of Black and brown people have been in tune with the Palestinian people. Hamas.
I understand.
And so understanding that when you're in a situation like that, that you're not talking about America and Israel with two strong forces, you're talking about Palestinians against Israel with no resources and a one
systemic oppression, a victim of systemic oppression who recognizes other victims of systemic oppression. I totally recognize.
I feel there's a lot of white people in this country that are scared that one day we're not going to want reparations. We're going to want revenge. We're going to want.
Understand?
So, and it's not, and we are not that people. We haven't been that people. We are not that people. But the thing is that we're in a society that tells us violence is not the answer while also killing us systemically and physically. And so, again, I acknowledge the horrors and atrocities of what Hamas has done. And I don't, you know what I mean? Like, I don't want murder, all these things. It's all wrong to me.
Yeah.
I am not excusing anything, just like I hope no one's trying to excuse what Netanyahu is doing, excusing anything.
No, I hear you, and I agree with you.
But what I am saying is that I've seen the systemic oppression, and again, it ain't what the Palestinians are going through for sure. It ain't what they're going through in Sudan and the Congo for sure. But I believe that we have to continue to vote and to stand up and be counted. But I don't believe the change that is some days life or death, the change that I want to see that is some days life and death for so many of us, is not going to happen from voting because of how that has to play out.
Okay, if I may, this thing of Cop City is extremely upsetting to me, and I've been speaking about it from the very beginning. I have been down.
President Biden wants to make this a model for the rest of the country.
I couldn't agree with you more. I was very loud about that on my campaign. I have been down to Atlanta. I've met with Cop City protesters. I've had Zooms. I've had Tortuquita's mother on. Tortuguita's death was the first time an environmentalist activist in this country has been murdered by state authorities. I confronted the mayor of Atlanta about this at Bernice King's birthday party, and you wouldn't believe how he came at me.
Yeah, oh, I can believe it.
And I was being very respectful, actually, because I knew where I was and who I was speaking to. What you just said about how they want to use it as a template, I couldn't agree with you more. But I want to go back to closing the loop between that and all of these people who say, so the reasons not to support a person. For instance, when you say voting wouldn't help, I disagree with that.
In the immediate.
No, I understand. No, but hold on. Let me just make my point, if I may. If you had a presidential nominee who said in her first statement, and we're going to talk about Cop City now, and I will use the full forces of the executive branch of the U.S. government. So to say that it doesn't matter who wins, we haven't had a person elected in so long who would take on such powers. But then to use that, so the thinking is so straight, it's convoluted, because it's saying we haven't had a person who's taken those powers on, therefore electoralism doesn't help, when actually, why don't you support a candidate who would?
No, listen, I agree with you.
Yeah, not you personally. No, I know, we're in agreement. And if I may, I want to go back to something else that we, I would submit, and tell me if I'm wrong, I would submit that some of those who say, oh, her privilege, whatever, it's their privilege at work. Their privilege. They're now in with the Democratic elite.
Yes.
Who's talking from privilege here? You know what privilege means? Privilege is the phone calls you can have returned.
Yes, very much, very much.
That's what it's about.
Well, you know, let me be specific too when I talk about privilege as well, so that the people who are listening can really have an understanding. I talk about this with other guests on the podcast as well, but privilege is perspectival, and privilege is relative, in the sense that what I know about privilege being perspectival and relative is when we talk about ableism, so many people are unaware of their ableism because it's so basic of, I have the privilege of seeing or hearing in this moment, and haven't even thought about the fact that somebody else might be in this room not seeing or hearing, and not knowing that whether it's able-bodied privilege, whether it's white privilege, whether it's what I've experienced as cis-assumed privilege, meaning people don't know that I'm trans when I go to the airport and when I go to certain places, that many of these instances of privileges can be converted into power in the moment to create shifts and create certain things.
I'm very aware of that.
What I feel like is that the mass is not aware of their blessings, of their privileges, of their power in certain ways because of the way that the system is. And so what I see as a situation and an issue right now, that is not just that the political system is corrupt and broken, but also the will of the people, I believe, is broken. I just mean traumatized from the things that we've experienced all this time. And I have friends and people who I'm recognizing in them, they don't have the fight in them. They want a good vibes only. They don't want to, you know, have these conversations. And the will to do the work that is going to challenge us all is a little shaky, is what I see.
Having run for president twice, my conviction has only been deepened that the American people are not the problem. I think the American people have a core decency. And I think a lot of this has to do with leadership. I think people hear you on the level that you speak to them from. And I have spoken to the rich and the poor, the black, the white, the brown, the gay, the straight, the non-binary, the trans, the agnostic, the atheist. And I see nobility everywhere I go. I know I was once, I've worked with imprisoned, and I was having a conversation with some prisoners. And I said, you know, we just really have to consider where the country should go. And I received as much seriousness people being appreciated, that your opinion matters. You'll be out of here someday, blah, 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 and taken seriously. People in some of the circumstances you would least expect, mm-hmm. who are more than capable, more than willing, and more than desirous of rising to the occasion beyond the labels that either they or society has put on them. We have got to move beyond all that right now. We've got to. We've got to come out of our silos. We're all wounded. You know, I am profoundly hard of hearing. So when people, I mean, that's what the word says on the test, right? Profound. So, I mean, people just throw these judgments at people. You're a this, you're a that. What are we doing? How about you're an American? And yeah, you're wounded.
It's less of a personal attack, and it's more of, we are living in an environment where this is a prevalent perspective, is ableism in a way, just like Beyonce, you know, had her concert and there was a big story that happened that this guy who has flown the airplanes before and did, you know, always has to check first to make sure that the airplane has room for his chair and whatever, and booked a seat to go there, and got to the airport and they could not fit his chair on the airport and he could not go to the Beyonce concert. She eventually, you know, did some magic and made it happen for him to be able to come to a concert. But this was just a moment in pop culture where folks were able to see a conversation that disabled folks are having all the time around being able to access regular things that we all take for granted. And the fact that it's not yet. And I think, again, you as someone who experiences being profoundly hard of hearing or what have you, I think, again, this is another layer that I think could add to your leadership in integrating, just as well as you talking the Black things, of talking about the ableism of this country.
Let me tell you something. I have a hearing issue. It has made me very, you know, when I talked about Medicare for All, it's improved Medicare for All. I've really appreciated Bernie Sanders. And this is not just as a person hard of hearing, but as a person who is aging, I understand how important glasses are. I understand important hearing aids. But I don't want to identify myself with my wounds. I don't want to. I think it's almost pathological. I don't
want
to.
Well,
at what point do we identify with, for me, it's that we're all wounded. We all have limitations. We all have whatever. We're all working on it. And we have to have a larger conversation about the country and the species that goes beyond judging each other. I don't know. That's just
No, listen. This is where you and I, I feel like I'm on the same page with you in general.
Well, I feel I'm on the same page with you.
Yeah. In the overall general sense of, we have to rise above these things, but in a patriarchal, white supremacist, imperialist, capitalistic society, we have to acknowledge the forces at play. And what I know is that in social justice spaces and a lot of these spaces, folks have been able to develop a language. And I know that some folks are like scared of this thing of folks calling out and being so specific in certain things, but it's been a tool that has helped folks learn what accessibility means. The conversation of not only making sure that environments I am in, establishments that I'm in, jobs that I am going into are accessible, but that also they understand it's not so foreign for me to have a conversation as a person with needs that I would ask for accommodations in these spaces. And so I think that, like, it's less of associating with your illness or sickness and more of the real need for the accommodation.
That you have permission, you feel permission to say, I mean, I agree with that.
Yeah.
I think with everything, there's the high side and the primitive side. There's the evolved and the primitive.
As a trans person who is grounded in my Buddhist spiritual lens and practice, I understand the importance of my lens and what I'm saying. However, I'm starting to run into some of the same challenges I think you run into, and I think that certain people run into, where we have to break the conversation down to a space that that folks can digest that doesn't just, because the beautiful pictures we paint, I get it. I feel it's such, and it allows freedom for everyone to access the vision within their own version of it. So that's why it needs to be talked about in such a big visionary way. But I think that it gets lost in translation. How do you and I begin to take the vision that we talk about creating and make it plain?
You know, it's interesting that when you talked about reason in the Course in Miracles, there's a line where it says, love restores reason and not the other way around. I think it's so important to point out to people that the direction the humanity is moving in is anything but reasonable. It's anything but reasonable. Spending all of our resources, so many more of our resources on ways to harm each other, even kill each other, than we spend on ways to heal each other, help each other, and thrive. When you say, how do we do that? I am a bit of a romantic about American history. And I think that the ideals that were embedded into our founding documents, despite the fact that those ideals of total equality and genuine social and political enlightenment were embedded by people who were risking their lives in order to sign that document, because if the British had won, they would have been killed. And yet 41 of the 56 signers were themselves slave owners. So that dichotomy between who we say we are, who generation after generation, there have been people willing to die in order to manifest, versus the fact that in every generation from the beginning, and even including ours, there have been forces who, for their own ideological and financial and or financial purposes, had no intention whatsoever of seeing those principles actualized, and have proven they would do whatever it took, even to the most heinous, to make sure that they were not. That struggle is our story. That both and is our story. We are both and. We have always been both and. And I think every generation reiterates the struggle, some more dramatically than others. We're living at a point of high struggle. But if you look at it historically, generations have risen up and ultimately pushed back. We answered slavery with abolition. We answered the institutionalized oppression of women with the women's suffragist movement. We answered the Gilded Age with the establishment of organized labor. We answered, our ancestors did, answered segregation with the civil rights movement. The way I see it, it's our turn.
To answer.
It's our turn, because today it's not a specific institutional reality of oppression. It's an economic paradigm, which is itself oppressive, because in every corner of our society, we keep bumping into the fact that corporate profits ultimately come before the health of people, the safety of people, the welfare of people.
We have you seen Ava DuVernay's film Cast? I mean, Origin?
No, I read the book, I hear that the movie is incredible, so I look forward to seeing it.
It's absolutely fascinating, and I'm glad that you read the book. I definitely have to now read the book after seeing the film. You know, but one thing I thought that was, it was a lot of things. It was very moving. I'm just thinking about some of the scenes, but like, what I think that became very clear to me is that it's been very clear for capitalism for a very long time that in order for it to work, at least that has been the prevailing thought for a long time, that it needs to subjugate a certain portion of the population. And so when you have not only the folks in India who are untouchables, but then you also have the women and children in the Sudan and the Congo, who we Americans have invested interest in things staying the way that they are so that we can have the cobalt and the technology. We continue to talk about a country being poor, and yet it has all of the resources that we take from it.
You don't even have to look at India, Sudan, and the Congo. You can look at neighborhoods in Chicago and Indianapolis and Los Angeles. Modern capitalism, uber capitalism, vulture capitalism, trickle-down economics, everything that is, we've really been ensconced in the society since the 1980s, is predicated on the existence of a permanent economic underclass, permanent underclass. So you can just start right at home and see that, and for the same reasons that you say. But the point I was making was that, to me, because when we talk about how do we burst through this, to me, and I've seen this with audiences, give the historical perspective. Now, what Isabel Wilkerson does is she gives a historical perspective globally throughout time. Mm-hmm. But if you just look at it here in the United States.
Absolutely.
And then I always say, Angelica, I always say, definitely we need to identify the problems in our past, because we need to in order to see their legacy in the present. But let's identify with the problem solvers.
Absolutely.
And in every case, those problem solvers were standing on, as their moral raison d'etre, the primary principles of the Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm. That in this country, we stand on the idea, not that we have ever perfectly manifested, nobody's naive enough to think that, but which at our best, we have expanded, and at our best, we have protected, mm-hmm. because of our belief in these underlying principles. To me, that is so powerful. And what I've seen, I think Americans have an instinctive understanding of that. But our politicians, like you and I were talking about at the beginning, the political system today actually leads people away from the memory of the whole point of this. Because the whole point of this is not that you get yours. The
yes.
whole point of this is that we together yeah. create a society in which anyone should be able to thrive.
You know, whether you are running for president or, you know, whether you are leading, you know, the Peace Alliance, I personally have really taken this chapter of my life, being 43, very seriously in my, not only my Buddhist foundation, but in my response to society and what the ails and the things of society need, where I need to show up, where I need to be present, where I need to grow, all of these different things. And so I personally want to always continue to offer myself to you and to your vision. I want to see what you see come true. I want to be a part of the Peace Alliance. I am still finding out in ways in which I can amplify my voice to speak to the UN and to challenge, again, the abolishment of nuclear weapons and all of these things. I do believe that, you know, peace is a way, but it has to be through an acknowledgement. I believe that, you know, again, I, as a Black trans woman and someone who's going through Nichiren Buddhism, when I talk to my own people at the intersections and in the margins, you know, I've had my challenges, and I may sound at times like I'm telling people to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, or I'm saying anybody can do it. I did it. I'm a trans person, a Black trans person who came from sex work, who came from these things. And I am saying that, and I do believe that, but I do also acknowledge the very real challenges and barriers in front of you. But what I want to do is to teach people how to see those things as minuscule, or to at least understand their power is greater. And
exactly.
when we talk, but you know, unfortunately, I think the spiritual abuse that when we talk about, and again, I hear you, and I believe what you say. I agree with you that the problem is not the people. It is this broken system. But I also do believe that we have work to do, you know, And I think that a lot of projection is on our own president candidates, on heroes. And
it's unbelievable, having been in that space, it's unbelievable how are you ever going to have what you say you want, not you personally,
yeah,
in a position of power, if you work so hard to tear down anyone who's trying, even the people who agree with you?
Absolutely.
I mean, you're talking about ableist. What have I ever done that's ableist? I mean, it's like you receive.
Well, but I want to give this to you so that maybe this will help. Just like I really because it's not. I don't think it's as big of a deal as anything. Because this is the thing. There was a conversation going on, and it went viral on the internet when I forget which comedian. It was some comedian that said they were being accused of being transphobic, and they were like, "That's ridiculous! Like, that's ridiculous. Call me transphobic. I have trans this and that, what have you." And I had to call up my friend T.S. Madison, who's a trans woman, a very popular trans woman in pop culture, and talk to her as a trans woman and say, "T.S., let me explain that you too are transphobic." And I have been transphobic too. As trans people, for us, we start out that way because we look in the mirror and we are judging ourselves and saying, look at how broad your shoulders are. Look at how deep your voice is. Look at how, so as a trans person, I grew up in a society that has a perspective against everything that I am and I'm breaking through. And I, through transition, have to go through this process of removing that film from what I see and how I see myself. And so it's not something that is, you're this type of person. It is that sometimes unconsciously, just because of the way society vibrates, is that we have opinions about women.
I think that's true. But at the same time, first of all, don't you have to have evidence? Doesn't somebody have to say or do something to justify these attacks? And number two, how can we ever say what's in somebody else's subconscious? I think a large part of what spiritual work is take care of your own growth.
Absolutely.
Take care of your own growth.
Absolutely.
Prison and a toxicity in the political space, and I see this as someone who ran.
But what does seeing the reflection
never get anywhere if we don't get off that?
But what does seeing the reflection harm? Meaning, I've had moments where I've been confronted with my ableism, with certain things, and not really realizing it, and then being like, actually, you know, you're right. I could be more aware of these things.
Well, I think that's every day. I think that should be all of our
I think that's all that this conversation is truly trying to get the center of. I think sometimes it gets to be that when folks have this sort of reaction to it that's like, well, I didn't do nothing wrong, or I'm not this, I'm not that. It's like, no,
well,
we're not
trying
to.
Can't you say that about anything?
Can't you say anything?
You might not admit it, but you have a racist thought. You might not admit it, but you have a white, American chauvinist thought. You might not.
Yes.
I mean, how can anybody live with that?
Well, I'm saying is we're not asking. What we're asking is for us no longer to live with that in a way that is unchecked. What they're saying is, as long as we talk about, I know one thing that is much better for me is dealing with the racist I know than someone I find out because they haven't challenged themselves. They just consider themselves to be a good person, but until they're put in ass or in certain situations, does it reveal. And I'm not saying just off jump of somebody saying, oh, you're this with no experience or fact. What I'm saying is the ways in which we have called out, the ways why, whether it's DEI, white women in certain in political spaces, all these different ways that we call out, these are the ways that we're saying you're being anti-black, racist, ableist, or what have you. And instead of rejecting it like Dave Chappelle, like all these different things, like our communities, we're saying, hey, what's wrong with acknowledging? We're instead of taking it personal that it's a personal attack and that it's more about we want to create a world and we want leaders who are able to at least recognize the ways in which they can have more inclusive language or anecdotes that recognize everybody can't walk. You know, like I do certain things, I'll have certain things, and I know it's overkill. I'm telling you for myself, as somebody that's in the movement, sometimes I feel, because I'll say, you know, this is crazy and whatever. And after I say that, immediately I say, I apologize. That's ableist. And it is, but So I try to use different words like wild and blah, blah, blah. And I try to model in the moment of, now, is that like, am I a terrible person because I just said that? No, I don't think so. But I think the call is to see someone that is aware of the opportunity to have a more inclusive language.
I think that there's a personal growth space in which you do that all day, every day.
Yeah.
And it's appropriate.
Yeah. I think a lot of people don't do it though, and they don't.
I'm in that space, and I've been in that for my whole life. So that's number one.
How do you get more people in that space with you, the white people that you are in community with?
We've got to get over this. It's my job to tell you what to do and you how to be.
But as a leader, as a leader who's running for president, you don't have to speak to other white people to tell them how to be less anti-black?
No, that's not. Well, what you can do is demonstrate something much better. But when you talked before, when you said the business of overkill, and you and I are talking about two different spaces. In the personal growth space, that's everything. You and I were having a personal growth. I'd say, Angelica, you just blah, blah, blah. And you say, Marion, you need, and it's understood and it's safe and it's merciful.
Yes,
understood.
Yes.
That's one space. I know that space well. I believe in it. And it is a 24-hour day and we owe it to ourselves and to our world. That's that space. Then there's the political space. It is more than overkill. It is soul murderous. And who the hell do people think they are that they think that they have the right all day, every day to call other people who they don't even know on their stuff in a way that completely diminishes the possibility that we can rise up as a movement and have any real political power?
I hear you. I absolutely hear you on the, you and I think are you... on the overkill. I hear you on that.
It's
and I hear
overkill. It is kill. And there is a word kill in there. It kills people's chances. It kills people's prospects. And when you do that to someone like myself, it wasn't just a betrayal of me personally or a wrong towards me or abuse, which I think it is a form of abuse. It's online bullying, actually. One person is insignificant. It's a betrayal of the dreams and the hopes and the larger images, the larger issues we're talking about here.
Well, I think on the other side of what you're saying, because I completely agree with you, but I think it's both-sided in the sense of what you're saying is the gap between folks' understanding and the vision that you're talking about. I think there's a similar gap between what the understanding is when folks call out these issues and what the practice is from those folks as well. Of being in good faith, of being like what we talked about, what would happen in the personal space, of offering in the political space, hey, you know, this perspective is a little anti-black, or this is racist, or this is this. If you say it like this, or I come from these organizations and this is the language that we've developed, or whatever.
And that's appreciated. I saw that so much. When people criticize me in a respectful way,
right,
I'm
right.
grateful. I'm
right.
learning. I'm growing. We're people.
Right, absolutely.
They are two completely different things.
I agree. I think it's a power dynamic.
That you consider your language should be different. And I'm like, oh, thank you so much. That's beautiful. That's growth when it's publicized. That's kind of wonderful. That's,
absolutely.
That should be part of the political.
Absolutely. But yeah, I agree with you. That should be a part of political. I think that folks aren't. What's happening is we were doing that during the presidential primaries, and Joe Biden has somehow managed to scathe through that as we were asking all of the questions that needed to be asked. And the right side doesn't do that kind of questioning and asking or what have you. I think that we definitely, and so in our Democratic Party, we aren't the fact that the DNC isn't holding a primary like they would if he was running differently again, that removes that conversation. It removes the ability for us to have that that full democratic conversation.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I definitely hear you on that. And I feel like I have experience, and I won't, you know, again, I don't think the people are the problem, but we can call out certain practices that can be evolved and need improvement. And I believe in the ways in which the language our social justice organizations and communities and grassroots organizers have developed, I think is pretty spot on with a lot of things. But I also think we have to be more intentional and more adamant about the nature of restoration and the availability of restoration it's not about a judgment, but that it is a calling, not a calling out, but a calling in to have a conversation.
Not the way it mainly is used.
Well, I'll say this though.
All I can speak about was my experience.
Well, and I agree with you, because that's the thing that makes this so murky, is because there's so many different experiences, in the sense where I might say, hey, this is a little heavy-handed over here. But in this instance over here, where folks are rejecting the call in and don't even want to have the conversation, that's a completely different response. And that's not the response that you've been giving. And so what I'm seeing on both of those things is the middle way, is the meat in the middle, where I think there's an opening that can happen on the side of those who are so enraged with wanting accountability, and those who are on the side of needing to be held, needing to offer accountability, because you're going into a leadership position that we're going to know that we have that pipeline too.
Political nonviolence is all about how to tell the truth within a space of mercy and love. Martin Luther King said, you have no morally persuasive power with a person who can feel your underlying contempt. Mm. And of course, if I feel knives coming at me,
I get that.
So you give more kind of credit to some of the attackers out there. You see them as people calling people to account. I see people working out childhood wounds that they haven't worked past.
I see that also, but I also see
the level of, and also when you were talking before about people on the right and they don't do this, I would agree with you that in many cases, they don't do the deeper personal investigation that you and I both agree needs to be made. But what they are is far more sophisticated, more psychologically astute about what it's going to take for us to actually achieve and maintain
what they want. Yeah.
Because this childishness, this childish tantrum, or whenever you see anybody that doesn't say exactly what you want them to say, the way you want them to say it, is the way to make sure our movement never has any more political power than we have now. So
I think there's a, I hear you. I'm in agree. I love this conversation, and thank you so much for having this. And I'm so glad.
Well, thank you. I think you're wonderful. I'm so grateful to you.
I am preparing for office, but you know, I'm consulting with people, but the problem is that I'm not saying the things I'm not willing to. I just, the conversation that's happening right now is not progressive enough for me, from even the Democratic establishment, especially.
Hold on. Even from the Democratic, hello, please. Yes. Even from the, yes, today's Democratic establishment is what Republicans were when I was growing up.
Right. Yes.
Yes. And that goes back to what you and I said when you asked some people and then they had these judgments on me. I would say they're privileged.
Yeah.
Because it's the privilege of being accepted by that crowd.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, you know, and I am going to be running, but, you know, I'm trying to figure out how to do that and still be myself, and how to do that and still come from the spiritual space that I come from, especially, again, as a Buddhist, under God we trust, meaning like, this country sees everything, but like, it just does not, it says it makes space for freedom of religion, but there's a lot of problems that make that not a daily reality for many different religions. And so when you hear these profound, like, I've learned hopefully to speak in ways that are intersectional spiritually, because there's so much of Buddhism that's just not, you know, it's just kind of just free. But coming from a Black trans woman, I know that it's going to be an uphill battle. But what I am trying to do is continue to build my power outside of the system until the people put me into it, in the sense that, like, the only reason why I'm even considering this is because after so many years, I got tired of being asked about it, especially like from White House people that I was in relationships with, you know, Aditi Hardikar, who was now is in the Treasury Department, but she was like a former White House LGBTQ liaison. She was in Clinton's. So all these different things over a decade, having people pull at me and be like, now, Angelica, when are you going to get into this? I'm like, never. Like, this, that's, I never. That's not what I want to do. I don't, I can see the plays. Like, to me, I don't know if I'm watching a presidential election half the time or the Super Bowl. The way that they talk about it or in the media is such a game. It's such a thing. And it's a thing that I see the things and I'm not sure. I haven't been sure that I can get in there and when there's so much of that. But what I know I can do, and I don't know if this is how you feel as well, but at the very least, I can stand as a stark contrast when I'm in the space.
Okay. So what I would say to you as a woman, do not limit yourself the way you just did. You just did, you said you did something women too often do. I'm not going to claim the whole thing, okay? Don't hate me. Don't hate me, okay? Don't hate me. And that's when they come after you, is when you claim, why not me? Why the hell not me? That's what I hope you will. And someday, let other people reach up to that. Why not her? Mm-hmm. You know, I would hear things from women as well as men, but you haven't served in office. Nobody says that about Bobby Kennedy. Nobody says that about Andrew Yang. Nobody says that about Vivek Ramaswamy. Yeah. So what I would say to you as a woman, look what you did. Look how you slyly, unconsciously, don't hate me. I'm just saying, maybe I could be a mark. No. Cancel.
Right.
And I would support you and saying, why not you? That would make me want you more. And let other men and women catch up to that.
Yeah. Yeah. I thank you again. Yes. Thank you so much. I will be in contact.
I think you're wonderful. Thank you for this conversation.
Thank you. And again, thank you for everything that you have contributed. I know that you are not here just for this one battle. I know that you are here for the entire thing, because I know that when someone has the kind of conviction that you do with your life, that means that you have to use your life, the span of it. I see it. I'm trying to do the same thing. Thank you for showing up the way that you do.
God bless you too. Thank you.
Bless you too. Thank you again, Marianne, for taking the time to talk with me. From this conversation, I gather that although Marianne and I don't agree on everything, I don't believe that she is any more dangerous than Biden or Trump. So when the Georgia primary rolls around, I will be voting. And I'm either voting for Marianne or I'm voting uncommitted. And before y'all send me a bunch of hate mail, please understand that this is what primaries are for. This is the perfect time to send a message to Biden that our votes should not be taken for granted. All right, before we go, I'm going to drop another Buddhist breadcrumb and talk about the concept of the 10 worlds. It's a doozy, baby. This is a Buddhist concept that illustrates the levels that our life condition can vibrate on. The world of hell, the world of hungry spirits, also hunger, the world of animals or animality, the world of asuras, anger, the world of human beings, humanity or tranquility, the world of heavenly beings, meaning heaven or rapture, the world of voice hearers, learning, the world of cause awakened ones, realization, the world of bodhisattvas, and the highest level of condition being the world of Buddhas or Buddhahood. So, simply put, we Buddhists believe that heaven and hell are right here on earth. Nietzsche and Daishonin writes, neither the pure land nor hell exists outside of oneself, but lie only within one's own heart. Awakened to this, one is called a Buddha. Deluded about it, one is called an ordinary person. The Lotus Sutra reveals this truth, and one who embraces the Lotus Sutra will realize that hell is itself the land of tranquil light. If you want to learn more about studying and practicing Nietzsche and Buddhism, you can visit sgi-usa.org, where they go into full detail about the 10 worlds. But I also recommend subscribing to their Buddhability podcast. And you can also visit nietzscheandlibrary.org for free to read the Lotus Sutra, as well as the writings of Nietzsche and Daishonin, where you can find the passage I just quoted from, hell is the land of tranquil light. But just so you know, the actions that you are taking right now will determine the vibrational frequency of your life.
being a Buddhist won't keep you from experiencing hell, but it will give you the ability to create a portal for yourself and others to get to higher ground. Someone you know might be in their own personal hell right now. So I want to encourage you all to become the kind of person who can help shoulder some of the pain and help someone see their way out of suffering. No opportunity wasted. Nam-myo-ring-ye-yo, 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 nam-myo-ring-ye-yo.